Hey guys, it's Lavetta.
And it's Miriam.
And this is the Notorious Women Podcast, a comedy podcast about some of history's most notorious women.
Yes, yes.
Welcome back for another week. And I know, I'm just going to say at the top of it, I know that we didn't put a disclaimer about what happened at the Olympics, because I know you covered Rebecca.
Yes.
And
we didn't.
No.
But Rebecca still won.
Yes.
First of all, her story is the same. I hate the Olympic people. I don't know what I'm saying, who I hate so much. Jordan Chiles. Like, I feel like America needs to stand up and storm the Olympic Committee. Do you know what I'm saying? Like Bastille Day, only Olympic Committee. And it's in France, so it works. Are they still there? I don't know. But yeah. Come on, that was some bullshit. Bullshit and racism. I'm just going to say it.
Yeah, and I think people were very upset, and rightfully so. And I think the only reason they did not storm it during Bastille Day is because she has other medals. But it's just sort of like,
I don't care. She got that bronze, and it was the correct score. It's not
so,
like
the
score was a mistake. That's not the issue. She did in fact score higher than that other lovely woman. I don't know. I'm sure she's fine. There's like, this is a technicality. You didn't request it in within the 4 seconds, you know, and they won't. And I have feelings. The U.S. has the receipts. They have the receipts that they had 4 seconds left when they went in to do the thing. I don't know the names of all the things, but they went in to try it again, right? So that's why the Olympic Committee isn't changing their minds. They won't see it. They're refusing.
So,
again, we have to storm the Bastille. Let's go.
Listen, I don't know about you. I ain't fucking with the French because they like chop off heads.
That's true.
But no.
They chop off the heads of the elite. They're not chopping our heads off because we have no power. Okay. We're the ones who are chopping the heads off.
Speak for yourself, because I feel like in a former life, I was at least in the court. No, because the court was very smelly.
You were not in the court.
I was in a court in like Africa or like
Because it was
outside. Call South America, where they had like hygiene and like and plumbing.
You're in Africa with plumbing. That's where you were. I know exactly where you were. And you were in charge of making sure it stayed clean. Like that was, don't mess with Queen Lavetta. Because if you don't clean this, she's going to kill you. Literally.
Or high priestess. Like, no.
High priestess.
I just wanted to acknowledge that, because I know we didn't do a disclaimer before last episode dropped, because we had already recorded literally the day before. So
it was the day before. Yeah.
Yeah. So but I guess we should get started this week. This week, my dear, you are first. And also, guys, before we get started, though, remember to leave us a 5-star review in the Apple Store. That helps people find us and follow us on all the things. I will also be telling you that again at the end of the episode. But
you can't escape her. Okay.
Miriam. Who is your notorious woman this week?
Okay, my notorious woman is a woman named Edith Louisa Cavell. Now, is it Cavell or is it Cavell? I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I think of Henry Cavell, which is spelled differently, but he's hot. And so I think of him.
He is pretty.
That's it. Okay. Yeah. I'm happily married. Thank you.
But you can still look.
I'm not dead. I'm just
especially
married.
At movie stars. Come on, that's what they're there for.
It's not like Henry's like, "Hello, Miriam," and I'm like, "Oh, Henry," and he'll be like, "Would you like to leave your husband for me?" You know, and I'll be like, "No, Henry, I can't stop. Don't know. You know, I don't think that's on the table." So
you're like, "No, stop!" With your legs wide open. Okay,
how dare you? And yet, see. We told you guys we were British, okay?
And I, forgive me, of course, the leaf blower start as soon as we start recording. But anyway, listen, go ahead, my friend. So, okay.
It's ambiance. Okay.
Yes.
Let's so get back she to was, you. She was born in, now remember, sometimes the Brits don't know how to pronounce their own towns. Swordston? That sounds good. Near Norwich in England. I can say the word England. Okay. On December 4th, 1865. So her father was a reverend. He was the vicar in that town for 45 years. His name was Frederick Cavill. And her mother was Louisa Sophia. And I think mom was a homemaker. They don't say what she did. So she was the oldest of four children. Cool. Okay. So she, I feel like she was whatever middle-ish class was. You know,
yeah, she was the daughter of a vicar, so yeah.
Yeah, like in Pride and Prejudice, where it was like they had the house and somewhat of a standing, but not a ton of money. This is what I imagine.
Yeah, not a ton of cash.
Right. But she was educated at Norwich High School for girls and then went to boarding schools. So I feel like she got...
That is my... I'm so sorry. That is totally...
That was... No, I heard it. It was loud.
The leaf blower. I'm always in a fight with the leaf blower.
Okay.
So I please forgive if you guys hear that. And I think you guys can relate to that as well. But all right.
So she was a governess for a while, which is why I think she wasn't rich, because she needed a job. And she worked for a family in Brussels between 1890 and 1895. Now, her father got ill right around 1895, so she came home to help care for him. And this inspired her to become a nurse. So, in April of 1896, at the age of 30, okay, girl, she applied to become a nurse probationer at the London Hospital under matron Ava Lucas, I don't know, S-L-U-C-K-E-S, you tell me. So, and I think it's really interesting, and I didn't read, there's no conversation about dating or men availability or anything like that. No, 30 years old, she's like, I'm being a nurse. And everyone's like, cool. I like that. I like that
too.
A lot.
Yeah.
So she worked in various hospitals in England. She was a private traveling nurse. She treated patients in their home. And she would treat all kinds of patients with all kinds of problems. Nothing stopped her. So she was sent to assist with a typhoid epidemic in Maidstone in 1897 and was awarded the Maidstone Medal. So I don't know. I think there was a medal created for the nurses. I mean, I think that's what happened, because there was an epidemic around there, and she was, her and a few other nurses just went around. I mean, such a dick. Can you imagine? I mean, you can imagine, because you and I saw an epidemic and went, I'm going to stay home. I'm going to close the door. Exactly. I'm going to wear a mask if I absolutely have to leave this door that will remain closed behind me.
Exactly.
So in 1907, so I feel like she was doing the nurse thing there for a while, for like 10 years after that, right? She was recruited by Dr. Antoine Despages to be a matron, or the matron, of a newly established nursing school called, okay, so it's in Brussels. And so here is my French. Are you ready? It's so good.
I'm ready. Yes.
L'école belge d'infirmerie diplômée. I could have also said the Birkendale Medical Institute, but I did not want to.
Okay. You're just showing off, which I love. I know, if I could speak French, I would do that too. Yeah.
Bonjour, Lavetta. Comment ça? Okay, stop, Miriam.
All my
stop
French
now.
Is just from Pepe Le Pew, which is very insulting to the French people.
Oh, no. Yeah, yes. That's not okay.
Yeah, don't do that.
Okay, so within a year, she was training nurses for 3 hospitals, for 24 schools, and it said for 13 kindergartens in Belgium. So I guess the school nurse?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about
which
that.
Maybe that was like a new idea, right?
Yeah.
So she was offered then a position as matron in another, I don't know if it was another Brussels clinic or I'm not really sure, but she did work closely with Dr. Despages. Now, he realized that the care being provided by religious institutions had not been keeping up with medical advances.
Hmm.
So they went to a new secular hospital. So I think this is when she changed, at St. Giles.
Okay.
So she could learn a little more and get...
Okay.
Because her... She lived her life searching for knowledge and going where... Now, I'm not trying to like knock religious institutions, but historically, they don't necessarily... They come in after.
Yeah.
The new, right?
Yeah.
So World War I broke out. She was actually at home visiting her mother. So she was in England when it broke out. Oh. So when she returned to Brussels, her clinic and her nursing school had been taken over by the Red Cross.
Oh.
In November 1914. So the German then occupied Brussels. So after they chose to do that, she began sheltering British soldiers and funneling them out of occupied Belgium to the neutral Netherlands. Now, wounded British and French soldiers, as well as Belgian and French civilians of military age, were hidden from the Germans and provided with false papers by Prince Reginald de Croix at his Chateau of Bains. That was bad. That was bad.
It was funny, though.
Thank you.
you know, so, but before you go on, I just want to say, so she was born in 1865. So in America, that's the end of the Civil War.
Right.
And she's like still relatively young during World War One.
Yes. Wow. Isn't that... You don't think about that, right?
No, you don't think that people living could be living in the same time period.
Because you just see it as like we, that's why you and I talk about it all the time. Like slavery really wasn't that long ago.
Nope.
It really wasn't.
Nope.
You got to stop. Oh, it's ancient history. It's literally not, because there is such thing as ancient history, you guys. Look, it's real.
Let's say she was 15. She was born in 1850. So by 1914, she's just 64 years old.
Yeah. It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that far. Fine. Wow.
But she was born in 1865. So.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is like just for context, like.
Yeah.
A person could very well be 20 when the war ended.
Yes.
And then, be 70 in World War One.
Yeah, you guys.
Yeah.
So let's just say slavery is bad. Repeat after me. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Run us our money. Reparations now.
That's right.
Oh,
it's real.
Oh, yeah.
Again, like people think it's just like a talking thing. I know, because I've talked to people and I'm like, no, it's real and we can do it and we should do it.
But the fact that she's like still a relatively young woman during World War One, and she was born in 1865. It hit me when you said that. I was like, oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course she would
it's
be.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Right. And it's funny. I don't think I would have clocked it as much if she was born in 1867, but 1865 is such a number
in America.
In America. Everyone knows that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, everyone except people running for
actually, except for the president. Politicians who wear red hats. Okay.
Boom, I had to do it. I could not resist.
I'm with you, girl. I'm with you.
Yeah.
I love the America I made up in my head. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Okay. Good for you. I don't mean that. Okay. So they were hidden from the Germans. Now, what they did was these men, right, were conducted by various guides to her house, to a man named Louis Severin, and like others in Brussels. Like there were safe houses, basically. And then they were furnished with money to reach the Dutch frontier. And they were Okay, so a man named Philippe Bock provided them with guides to the Dutch frontier. Okay, so this made her break the law of the German military. But she knew it, and she was okay with it, because remember, in both World War I and World War II, the German military, they were wrong. Just a,
yeah.
Another clarification. Okay.
Yeah, they didn't learn from the first time.
Yeah. Okay. So German authorities were becoming increasingly suspicious of her actions. She was also very outspoken.
Oh, yeah. You need to be down low, girl.
Girl, you need to be like, Heil things. I can't say the whole thing, but you know what I'm saying.
She's British, and I have to say, the British, as much as I love them, they're very like, oh, I'm better than the rest of you all.
Well, this is unacceptable. Absolutely not.
And y'all know it. Our British listeners, y'all know we're telling the truth, too.
It's so true. Come on, keep calm and carry on.
She's giving me very strong Karen vibes, yeah. But she's on the right side.
Yeah. And I also read, I can't quite find more about it, that she basically helped anyone that needed help. So she also helped German soldiers. She was there to save lives. And I don't know for sure, but I think some were defecting. And she was like, that's fine. But she was helping. She was a nurse. She took that very seriously. She took her oaths very seriously. I assume nurses have oaths. I don't actually know.
I mean, you're the expert on Call the Midwife, so you tell me.
I know. I slowed down. I slowed down my season 9.
Okay.
But I should know. You're right. I basically am a nurse at this point. Yes. At least a midwife, right?
Yes, at least a midwife.
Ah, thank you. So on August 3rd, 1915, she was charged officially with harboring Allied soldiers. There's a douche bucket named Georges Gaston Kien who betrayed her. That's right. I'm calling him out.
He's a rat. snitch.
But he was later convicted by a French court as a collaborator. So at least he got his. Okay. Now she was held in St. Gilles prison for 10 weeks. The last two of which were spent in solitary confinement. So she made 3 depositions to the German police on August 8th, 18th, and 22nd, admitted it, that she had been instrumental in conveying about 60 British and 15 French soldiers, as well as about 100 French and Belgian civilians of military age to the frontier and have sheltered most of them in her house. At her court martial, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people to be secretive.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That's impressive.
So she was prosecuted for aiding British and French soldiers. For the things I just said, she was prosecuted. She admitted her guilt. This is interesting. When she signed a statement the day before the trial, she declared that the soldiers she had helped escaped, thanked her in writing when they arrived safely in Britain. Not only did she like, I did it, but she was like, I did it, and here are the receipts.
Okay.
She's like, did it. I fucking did it. That's right. Y'all are dicks. I'm putting words in her mouth. I don't think she said
that. Can you imagine? Yeah, she's a much more proper lady than you and I.
For
but
sure. For
can
sure.
you imagine? They were like, you are charged with, you did it. Yeah, I did it.
Yeah.
They're like, oh. Okay.
She was like, and here is the letter. My dearest Edith.
Like, thank you for rescuing
on.
Us.
Like, I love it. Like, yes, Edith. Okay. Okay. So they basically were like, yeah, bitch, you did it. And they convicted her. So the punishment, surprise, is death.
Yeah.
Now, the first Geneva Convention ordinarily guarantees protection of medical personnel, but the protection is forfeit if it's used as cover for any belligerent action, which she super did, which I'm fine with, but she super did that. So they were justified in murdering her. I'll say it. It's murder.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, the British government couldn't do anything to help because it followed like the rules of law under war, which is kind of like a ridiculous statement, honestly. Stop killing people. Thank you.
Yeah, because all decorum and law really goes out the window with
war, I mean, it just kind of does. So how about like, let's not murder her. Come on. Just like,
for
her
to
out.
Like, but also like for her to not break the law, she just has to attend to the people that the enemy has harmed, like, you know what I mean? Without
like,
doing anything.
That's true. Or I could prevent it. I could prevent it.
Yeah. So that's probably why she was like, yeah, motherfuckers, I did it. I did that shit. Yeah.
Here's another one. My darling Edith, thank you so much for literally saving my life in your house and then providing me with money.
This is so gangster, though, because you know she was like a proper English lady and she's a nurse. And so but it's such a gangster move. Like, yeah,
I know. I'm just like, I got tons of them because I'm an amazing person. Okay, so England couldn't help her, but the United States had not entered the war yet, so they could try. And so they sent Hugh S. Gibson, first secretary of the U.S. legation. Maybe I just wrote that wrong. Could be legislation. Probably legislation. Let's try that again. At Brussels, made clear to the German government that executing Cavell would further harm Germany's already damaged reputation. Which is super true. Okay. So,
yeah, because it doesn't look good to kill a nurse. Like,
they were like,
you know what I mean? Like,
you already sunk the Lusitania. Do you really want this murder of this woman nurse? Do you? Okay, so Count Harrach, I don't know, did I say that right? Okay, he is in German side, said he would rather see Miss Cavell shot than have harm come to the humblest German soldier. And his only regret was that they had not, quote, 3 or 4 old English women to shoot.
Oh,
so
oh,
damn. Oh. Okay. Okay.
Wow.
But also, she saved German soldiers too. Like, she wasn't like hurting German soldiers, Count Harrach.
That's very aggressive. My word. I'm clutching my invisible pearls.
Yes, the vapors. Whew.
He was like, not only do I want to shoot that bitch, I want to shoot 3 or 4 more just like her. Oh, damn.
Yes.
Oh,
shit. Yes. Okay. Well, okay. So she was defended by lawyer Sadi Kirshen from Brussels. There were 27 defendants and 5 were condemned to death. And she was one of them. So, P.S., she wasn't arrested for espionage, but for war treason. And if you care about those technicalities, I'm here to share that with you. I don't really know the difference.
What's the difference?
I don't know. Well, because they think that she might have been recruited. Okay, this is cool. By the British Secret Intelligence Service.
Oh, so I guess espionage is like... like connected to like secrets and passing of information.
Yeah.
And she was just like saving people.
So,
okay.
In 2015, former director general of M15, I think that's in the US side, Stella Rimington. I don't know though.
No,
it could be that's
no,
British.
MI5. Yeah. Yes. That's British.
Remember Scandal?
Yeah.
That is where I get my knowledge.
B613. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm thinking.
No. MI5, because that's what M is head of in James Bond.
Oh,
M is head
listen,
of,
like, yeah. That is why your friends should be smarter than you. No. Because then you look smart. Because I look stupid, but I'm friends with you, so now I look a little smarter. Thank you.
Because I'm British. British. Oh,
right.
Right. But then I get confused because there's like MI6 now, and I'm like, so I have to go back and do my research.
No, exactly. Yeah. Our sound guy is going to have so much fun editing this, by the way. Okay. Was that a sound you wanted to make, Miriam, or no? It was, Sean. It was. Okay. She announced in 2015 that she had unearthed documents in Belgian military archives that confirmed an intelligence gathering aspect to her network. So she was not just a nurse Oh no, let's give her her due. She was fighting on the good side. Yes, girl. So when, okay, so there was a whole thing of like she was questioned in French, but her trial was minuted in German, which some assert that this gave the prosecutor the opportunity to misinterpret her answers. But in their defense, she was like, I did it. And she was like, I would do it again. You know what I'm saying? So
she said, I did that shit. What you gonna do now?
Mm-hmm.
She sounds religious because she's like, I want to be a martyr. Like,
no, she actually says, okay, so they did. She does die. Okay. So the night before her execution, she tells Reverend Sterling Gunn. And remember, her father was a vicar for 45 years.
Right.
So, you know, she's like, I have a higher purpose and I'm doing it. So he was the Anglican chaplain and he had been allowed to see her and give her her Holy Communion. She says, patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness towards anyone. Damn.
Wow.
That's amazing. I have so much hatred and bitterness towards so many.
I have a lot of grievances.
Listen.
You know, what's my man name? Festivus from Seinfeld. I got a lot of grievances that I'm starting with you.
Oh my God. Of course you're bringing up Festivus from Seinfeld.
Of course.
So her final words to the chaplain were recorded as, quote, ask Father Gahan, I think that's how you say it, to tell my loved ones later on that my soul, as I believe, is safe and that I am glad to die for my country. She was then shot by a firing squad at Tir National Shooting Range at 7 a.m. October 12th, 1915. She was 49 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. I know, right?
That's fucked up, man.
Now, there's a fair amount of, like, homages to her. There's a statue on St. Martin's Place in Trafalgar Square in London with the which her sentence patriotism is not enough. And however, after she died, this is what inspired their, what's the word where you get people to get up in arms and go to their, what's that? Recruitment.
Recruitment?
So their tool for recruitment was her in England and in America. They were like, these people murdered a nurse woman.
Yeah. And they didn't think that through because it's like.
No, they didn't. So to a large degree, this whole story helped the Allies win the war.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
It became a rallying cry.
It became a rallying cry. Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. I know, right?
I love people who are like, see, I need my white allies to be more like her and John Brown. I need them to be like, motherfuckers, let's go.
I know, right? I'm not helpful.
We had to be violent.
I'm terrified. I'm like, Lavetta, what's happening?
I like them to be like, I mean, John Brown was so gangsta, even black abolitionists are like, chill, motherfucker, she's crazy. But it's also believed, they actually believed in what they practice and they believed in the religion that you need to do the right thing.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I feel okay. I don't want her to die and I don't think she should have, but she in herself felt a solid life spent. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah, no, she knew what she felt like she was on the side of good.
Right.
And I mean, even history has proven that she was right.
Yeah.
Because the fact that she also helped German soldiers and like,
she
so it wasn't like, oh, yeah, I'm going to help those people. You know,
she did not walk
have
away.
Grievances.
Exactly. Yeah. So, she's badass.
And also, you kill a nurse that's helping people during wartime. That's not a good look. Like,
you could have just like flown her out. And they said that they didn't want other women like sort of hiding behind the fact that they're, but maybe they shouldn't have invaded countries. I don't know.
Well, I mean, that ship was sailed. But when, I mean, I'm also struck by him being like, yeah, I'm going to kill her and I want three or four more. Like, it's like, dude, you really are the villain. Like,
oh, like, Germany.
Yeah, oh, you know,
they come a long way, baby. You know.
Oh yeah, the modern day Germans are definitely the opposite. They're like, oh no, we learned from ours. We fucked around and we found out, and we don't want to do that no more.
They are. Like, I gotta say, yeah, like they are a fine example of going. Yeah, we met, like, America can't fucking do that, and we did it for hundreds of years, and we're like, did we though? And we're like, yeah, no, like we did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember someone telling me once, they're like, well, if you take away slavery and the Trail of Tears and what we did to the Native Americans in general, then America's a really great country. I was like, then America doesn't exist.
Like, doesn't exist. And also, don't leave out the Chinese building the railroads.
Oh, they forgot that.
Wouldn't exist.
And all that other bullshit. And they, of course they know it.
And this, here's the thing. Like, it's, when I hate when people, because they just, I hate racists in America automatically assume if black people have any kind of pushback, it's like, you're ungrateful. And then it's like, no, motherfuckers, we love our country. What we're just saying is, it's just like being an adult, being a human being. It's okay to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Just say, I'm sorry, and move on. And stop making those mistakes.
I mean, it really is like a lesson we teach our five-year-olds. You know what I mean? Like, we can't take it back. You know, white people are so defensive. And it's like, you can say, I'm sorry that this happened and it should never have happened. And how can we make things better? And everyone's going to be fine with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
honestly, black people, we would be happy if y'all just stopped fucking with us right now.
That's like, a good step.
Just leave us alone. Stop following us around in stores. Stop stopping us unwarranted on your suspicions. Just leave us the fuck alone. Like, did you hear about that couple recently? I don't know, it probably somewhere in the South, because my people in the South, we just stay being a stereotype. But this black man was at a restaurant and they were harassing him and joking about there's a hanging tree.
Jesus.
And it was and they own this establishment, and he was probably the only black person around, so they felt emboldened, and other white people there were laughing, and he filmed it, and they were like very emboldened, even though they know they were being filmed, and they called the cops. Somebody called the cops, probably the man that was being threatened, and the cops came, and the cops were like, oh no, y'all motherfuckers going to jail. And they were shocked that they were going to jail.
Yes! So, I did not hear this.
And it's like, this man is just trying to get a hamburger? Like, seriously. Just leave him alone. Like, he's trying to get like a chicken sandwich?
Okay, this is a great example when people say, I hate saying his name, so I'm just going to call him T-Dog. He's orange. You know who I'm talking about.
Sir Orange a lot.
What he did to this country. Now, do you remember, I forget her name, she's a Food Network star, Paula Deen. And they found her, right? Turns out, oh, she's a racist white woman. And she lost all of her shows. Her restaurant, I think, closed down because we went, no, we're not accepting that. Now we're relieved that the owners were taken to jail. Do you know what I'm saying? But they still have the restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. These people will come.
This is the difference between the America before and the America after.
Listen to black people. These people never went away. They just...
Yeah.
And they weren't really ashamed of being racist, but they knew that publicly was not a good look. Unlike the Germans in your story.
They knew
it's not a good look. But when he came out, they're like, oh, we can say what we still believe. Like, okay.
Right. And that's worse. Like, people are like, I don't know what's better. What's better is when they shut the fuck up. That's better.
That's better. Yeah, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Like, I was on a Zoom last night, I was on X, excuse me, Twitter. I'm still calling it Twitter. And it was basically, they've turned it into Clubhouse. You know what Clubhouse is?
Yeah, vaguely.
Okay, yeah. So it's like one of those rooms or whatever. And the ridiculing the interview, quote unquote, with Elon Musk and Sir Orange-a-Lot. Mm. And they were ridiculing. And then these guys hop in, like libtards. It's some guy. And they were shouting him down. I was like, I'm here for all this energy because these motherfuckers don't have a right to talk because all they're going to do is spew lies and ridiculousness because they think 100%. We're idiots.
Yep.
And it's like, shut the fuck up and get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
But they were just doing it with facts.
So, good. I like that.
It's no two-sizism, whataboutism. Get the fuck out of here. Like, you know, I like that energy. Like,
yeah, I don't understand. When kids are on the playground and there's one kid who's bullying all the other kids, that bully needs to be pulled off the playground. It's not like, oh, well, I mean, let's hear the bully side. No, bitch.
Yeah, we're not listening to the bully side anymore. Okay. So cry me a river, but I'm here for this energy. So,
yeah.
But thank you so much for sharing your story.
Who do you have today?
Well, my notorious woman she's an interesting, and I was kind of afraid. I was like, oh God, I hope Miriam doesn't do this because she's sort of in the zeitgeist now. Okay. You may not know her because you have a life and you don't have a lot of time to be looking at BS. So my notorious woman this week is Jennifer Pan.
Oh, no, I have no idea who she is.
Oh, okay. This is going to be good. Okay.
Okay.
So there's a lot of information here, so I might go a little fast because I don't want to keep us too long, but this is very, very interesting. So Jennifer Pan was born on June 17th, 1986 in Markham, Ontario, Canada.
Okay.
To Bik Ha Pan and Hue Han Pan, immigrants who had fled Vietnam in 1979.
Okay.
They were of Chinese descent, but they were immigrants from Vietnam. So, they came to Canada. In 79, and they came to Canada for a better opportunity for their kids, you know, very typical immigrant story. Both Jennifer's father, now her father is, I'm going to refer to him as Han Pan, and her mother is Bik Pan.
Okay.
So, both her parents, her mother and her father worked at an auto parts manufacturer called Magna International. So they worked there for many years. They worked their way up and eventually they became like a very successful immigrant story. They bought a home. They had a Lexus and a Mercedes. Yeah. And in the 2000s, they had basically accumulated about $200,000 in savings.
Damn.
Yeah. So they worked hard. And
even in Canada money, that's a lot of money. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And that's in American dollars. That's So that's a lot of money.
I actually don't, like, full disclosure, I don't know the exchange rate. I made shit up. Okay, go on.
Yeah, it's just a little bit, but that's a lot of money in either currency. So Jennifer was the youngest of two and she had an older brother named Felix. But she was the only girl, and growing up, she had a difficult relationship because her parents, expectedly, were very strict and demanding, and they had very high expectations for her and her brother. So they closely monitored her after-school activities as well as her school activities. This is a very typical Asian American or just even immigrant, I think.
I think it's expectations. Solid immigrant story. Yeah,
yeah. For sure. I went to school, full disclosure, I went to school with a lot of Asian Americans, first gen Asian Americans. So even though I didn't experience this myself, I have, this is very like close to my heart. And I have a lot of like just secondhand experience with seeing my friends go through a similar kind of dynamic with their parents. So she was taught to achieve, both of them, not just academically, but with creatively, nonstop piano lessons, competitions, figure skating.
Oh, wow.
So it's that, again, very, very typical sort of like what you hear like that. She basically, her parents were tiger parents.
I was going to say the tiger mom. Everyone knows the tiger mom, right?
Yeah, exactly. So she and her friends, because Canada has a large Asian American population in general. Does. So she could commiserate with some of her other friends who had similar kind of things going on at home. And, but they were like bummed out.
If we're going to like compare, like as a Jew, like the Jews have it just it's a different take, but it's a similar thing. This is a different take.
And keep in mind, like her we parents.
We don't achieve as much. I'll say.
I mean, also because you come in America or Canada, you're like second, third, fourth, fifth generation in. You're just like, we're all Americans, right? But in their minds, a lot of times they are like, don't be lazy like the American kids. But it's like the parents, I think, sometimes don't understand. There's a misunderstanding of each, right? So the parents are coming from, now they're coming from Vietnam in the 70s, right?
Listen.
But they are also Chinese immigrants, ethnically Chinese in Vietnam and then coming to Canada. So her parents been through some shit, pretty much.
Listen, because, and everyone, and anyone of any sort of minority, which is most of this country, so I don't know why people vote for the orange person, but, you know, it is a majority of this country, understands that the only way you can rise above is through education, is through. And so when you're really desperate and you're desperate for your children to not just survive, but thrive in a way that they were not able to because of circumstance, you go crazy. You know what I mean? Like, I get it.
Yeah. And I think that, to be fair, I also think that the parents don't quite understand what the children are going through. The children are not in Vietnam or China. The children are in America and have to interact with American children who come from all different kinds of backgrounds, or Canadian children who come from all different backgrounds, who also socially the kids are being raised differently than what the parents are being raised. But the parents are like, well, we didn't have time to socialize, like we had to work and because it was so hard. Yeah, but it's like, that's not your children's reality. So there's like a lot of misunderstanding. I see both of, I definitely understand the parents' point of view. The parents are like, ain't nobody got time to be pussyfooting around. But then it's like, you also don't want, the parents don't understand is that they're the weird kid if all they do is study.
No,
and take piano lessons. Like, you have no, they have no social skills, so they're the weird kids, and they're already othered because they are of Asian descent in a non-Asian majority country. So the parents are not quite understanding, but I also understand the parents' point of view because I'm older, and we know, because also to the kids, it seemed like maybe inevitable. Oh, like their parents work hard, they made it. But the parents know that they could have come to Canada and none of that shit worked out.
Listen,
they're also very much aware of that.
I'm pretty sure that you and I would be a good therapist team for the whole family. I think we understand the child. I think we understand the parents. Let's all just meet in a room, time travel back, and we can solve the problems. Okay.
Yes. And they definitely needed this. So again, she was, but Jennifer was determined to, you know, especially early on, because these are parents. She wants to, you know, impress them. She wants them to be proud of her. And she's also being a kid, got, and she got her own internal life. So she was a dutiful daughter of immigrant parents. So she did her best. She went to school, graduated, and despite not having what she called a stomach for medicine to satisfy her parents' wishes, she enrolled at in college at Ryerson University, and then on to went on to Toronto University to study pharmacy because she's like, I don't like all that blood and stuff. So
Yeah, same.
And they're like, okay, well, that's a legitimate job. That's like a respectable job that can make that pay well, right? And her side note, her brother became an engineer. So now both colleges, Ryerson and Toronto University, were far away from her parents' home. So after she graduated from high school, she stayed at home and she just would commute to college. Okay. And it was about 2 hours each way every day.
Oof. That's
a
terrible
lot.
Yeah.
So her, so while still at Ryerson, she said to make her commute easier, she asked her parents if she could just move in with a friend that was closer. Her father's like, again, she's graduated. Wow. She's of age, but, you know, they're very protective. So, but her mother was like, yeah, I think that's a good idea. So the mother convinced the father. So Bic convinced Han. And so he was like, okay, this is, if it's going to lead to her being successful in college, then yeah, let's do it. And then she's of age. So this arrangement, they came up with this arrangement, and it continued after she graduated from the Toronto University. And when she began working at a local blood testing lab called Sick Kids.
Okay.
So all seemed to be going well, you know, except Miriam.
What happened?
A lot of this, most of this was lies that Jennifer came up with.
Oh my God, what actually happened? I need to know.
So Jennifer was keeping many, many secrets, one of which was that she had a boyfriend by the name of Daniel Wong that she began dating in the 11th grade in high school.
Okay.
Now, her parents were very strict, so she did not dare tell them that she had a boyfriend.
Absolutely not.
And especially not one like Daniel. She probably could have told them about Daniel had he been more acceptable. She fell for him again, you know, like a lot of young love, you know, she fell
teenagers for this guy. Are stupid. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And Daniel was also, I believe Daniel's also of Chinese descent, but he was basically, he was a senior when they started going out. So he was an upperclassman to her. And he basically was a restaurant worker and sometimes low level drug dealer.
Okay. Here we are. Oh, and she's studying pharmacy. Okay.
So basically, she's a good girl who fell for a bad boy.
Yeah, she did.
And she, Jennifer, was smart enough to know, like, yeah, my parents are not going to approve of this. And so they actually kind of lost touch. And it also became more in her mind, Romeo and Juliet, because of him getting popped for selling drugs, he had to actually leave the school and go to another school.
Oh,
but she's
wow.
like, I love you forever. So in her mind, this is all like Romeo and Juliet, you know, mm-hmm. teenager,
yes,
15, 16-year-old, you know, that's exactly what's happening. So, but she and Daniel still kept in touch and they were dating even when she was in college, right? After high school.
Okay.
So they were dating. And it turns out also that, okay, I want to tease this out for you a little bit
because
this is like crazy. Okay. So, so her parents don't know about any of this, right? So they're thinking, oh, she's, you know, she's in college, she's going to college and all this other stuff. She's graduated and now she's out in the workforce. She's interning at this place called Sick Kids. So that's going to lead to like a really good job soon, right?
Okay. Okay.
But eventually her parents, because again, her parents have survived Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
Like
they've been
going to Vietnam, being of Chinese descent and coming to Canada and working their way up. These are not...
No.
Not just hardworking people, but they're not dumb people also.
Right. They're very smart.
And they have that parent third eye that parents develop, right? When they're like, something's off with these kids, right? So eventually her parents are like, something's off. So in early 2009, her father noticed that she never wore her uniform when she was going to work.
Okay.
Or even had a key card to get into the lab.
Like nothing. Yeah. Usually. Yeah.
Yeah, because these people, they work their way up probably from menial jobs or low level jobs at their company to like jobs where they can afford a Mercedes and a Lexus. So they're doing good. They're smart people. Right.
Okay.
So so following their suspicions, her dad's like, let us drop you off at work at the hospital one day. So when they dropped her off later on, we find out that Jennifer just sort of ran inside and hid in the emergency room because she was not working there.
Where was she working, Lavetta?
I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
So the next day, her parents called the friend. Remember the friend that she was staying with when she was in college?
Yeah.
And the friend admitted that Jennifer had never stayed with her.
Wow.
So the parents are like, what the fuck? You know, so she came home and they confronted her.
Yeah.
And she did fess up. She's like, I don't work at the lab. Also, I never attended the University of Toronto or the Toronto University.
What? Like never?
And instead of staying with the friend, the girl, she had been staying with Daniel's family.
Of his whole family?
His whole family.
Oh my God.
And instead of going to school and then working at the lab, she had just basically had a series of jobs at cafes, restaurants, and bars.
So wait, so she never went to undergrad? So they thought she went to undergrad and then went to grad school and she didn't know.
No, they thought she
that?
Went to like Ryerson and then transferred.
Oh, transferred.
And yeah.
And she did none of that. She did none of that.
Not only that, Miriam.
Okay.
She never graduated from high school.
What?
Wait.
What? How do you cheat that?
Okay, that is crazy regardless of who you are, your economic background, your social, your ethnic background. But
you can always graduate high school.
Asian parents?
Yeah.
They didn't know that part yet. They just are finding out about the job and the University of Toronto.
She's like a natural grifter. Like she was born to grift.
So her father was like, oh, you got to leave this house.
I see that.
Now, at this point, she is of age. She's like, what, 21, 22. So she's definitely of age.
Right.
And her father's like, well, you got to get the fuck out. And her mother's like, no. The mother's like, oh, my God. But, you know, obviously, they're reeling from all of this.
Yeah.
So for punishment, they confiscated her phone and laptop for 2 weeks. And she was only allowed to use them while her parents were around. She also would be subjected to surprise checks of her phone and any messages. And she was absolutely prohibited from seeing Daniel.
Okay.
And they forced her to quit all her jobs. At this point, she was also teaching piano and still going to piano class. But she was doing whatever she could to make money because, again, they think she's a success story at this point.
She didn't graduate high school. I'm still...
They don't know that part yet.
Okay.
They're just thinking, like, that's bad enough, right? So her parents began tracking the miles on her car. Like, they basically were like...
Yeah.
They pumped it up
over.
Even more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like I said, they didn't even know about the high school or that she never went to Ryerson.
Okay.
So she's been lying to them basically since high school.
Yeah.
Now, she was still determined to see Daniel because she's like, I love him. He's my Romeo, right? So one night she did, I don't know, maybe she's watching Home Alone. I don't know. She stuffed her bed full of blankets, that old thing, and then snuck out to see him. The next day, her mother went to her room and discovered she wasn't there. So they were like, I can only imagine, they were like so pissed and so in disbelief.
Yeah.
And they were like, absolutely no contact with this guy. You need to cut it off from him. Fucking, you need to get your shit together. Right?
Right.
And again, she sort of buckled down and was like, okay, because she knows she didn't have anywhere to go. Like, she don't have an education, so it's not like she can actually get a job.
So
she's like, I'm going to buckle down and we're going to, and they're going to get over this. I'm going to buckle down. I'm going to start doing right. And things are going to be fine. Right. That's what she's saying.
Okay.
So that was in 2009 that they found out. But before she could do that, in 2010, one night on November 8th, 2010, three men entered the house where she and her parents were living and shot them both multiple times.
They killed
her mother, Bic. Yep.
Jesus Christ.
And they severely shot her father. They severely wounded her father when they shot him in the face and the shoulder.
Oh.
So there's a frantic 911 call. Excuse me, where with Jennifer, and she's heard frantically talking with the operator, telling her that she's been tied up, and she's yelling to her father like, I'm okay, but these men entered our house. Excuse me, so sorry. So this has gone into like a movie, like a crazy like home invasion type thing. One of my favorite movies is Panic Room. And it's like that kind of thing, right? I love that movie. So it's so well done. Just crazy. And in the 911 call, she's just like, oh my God, I'm daddy. Like she's just freaking out. And so authorities come. Now, for context, these people live in a pretty upper middle class neighborhood. They have a very nice home. You see it. It's nice. It's a quiet neighborhood, a good neighborhood, no crime. So this is freaking frightening to people.
Terrifying. Yeah.
And she's saying in the thing that she hears a pop, pop, pop. Like she just keeps hearing a pop. And that she heard a pop. So she's like, please send somebody. So they come, authorities come, they find blood everywhere.
Jesus.
And they find that, Bic, her mom has been killed and her father is in a coma.
Jesus. Okay.
Now, later at the police station, they interview Jennifer and she tells them that three men pushed their way into her home and that one of them had tied her arms. Excuse me. I don't know what's going on. Let me drink some water.
Are you okay? So I don't know because I've never heard of her, mm-hmm. but I'm feeling a little suspicious because why? Why are the parents shot And why is she merely tied up?
Yeah, put a pin in that. That's that. Yeah, put a pin in that.
Okay.
So later in the interview, you know, they're like this young girl again, she's like 24.
Right.
And they're just like, oh my God, this is terrible. You know, this poor young woman, like she's in shock. So she tells them the three men pushed their way in, that one of them tied her arms, her hands behind her back and forced her into a bedroom where she had to give him approximately $2,500 in cash. He then made her go into her parents' room where he found $1,100 in U.S. dollars in her mother's nightstand. She told them of the description. She said there were three men, two of whom she knew were definitely black, one with a Jamaican accent and dreadlocks.
Okay. Girl.
So let me get to it. Now, police, again, this is a good neighborhood. Like... Mm. This is like, this kind of stuff does not happen. So they were like, oh my God, this is a home invasion gone wrong. The neighbors were freaked out. Again, terrifying. This is a very low crime area. And if there's crime, right. It's like menial kind of like, I don't know, somebody maybe breaking a car or something. It's like very, very minor.
Right.
So then they thought, oh, maybe Jennifer's father's not who we think he is. Maybe, you know, he.
Okay.
He has some gambling debts, you know. This may be where prejudice comes in because these are Asian 1,000%. People and these are white people investigating. So they're like, maybe he's involved with the Asian mob, you know. They don't know.
Based on the movie they just saw 2 months ago about the Asian mob. Yeah.
They started looking into the background and they trace, you know, both parents' background to the manufacturing. And they're like, oh, no, these are like upstanding people, nothing. And then they started to think, well, maybe they had targeted Jennifer, you know, maybe the kid in order to like put pressure on the parents to pay. Maybe it could be that. Eventually, they looked into Jennifer's background and they found Daniel Wong and his criminal background. Remember, I said he was like a low level drug dealer. So they brought in Daniel for questioning about his whereabouts and his drug dealing history. And then he was just like, oh, I got into some stuff when I was in high school, stupid stuff, you know, but I'm on the straight and narrow path, you know, and that could be true. He also told them that he and Jennifer had been together, you know, since high school, but and on and off. But then they had broken up some months previously, like several months previously.
Right.
And that he also said that a couple of months ago, he started getting a bunch of threatening text from an unknown number.
Okay.
So, and he also said that Jennifer had started getting threatening text. So they're like, oh, maybe there is something to this. And Daniel said that he had a new girlfriend by the name of Christine. So they're thinking maybe it's Christine is doing this to maybe has Christine targeted Jennifer. And when they talk to Jennifer, Jennifer's like, yeah, she could definitely have been targeting me because I was still talking to Daniel and she was jealous. And, you know, so it could be that. So they're just trying to make sense of this. I also think there's a part of them that's like, Asian people don't really get in trouble. So what is going on here? Yeah. I mean, let's be real. Right. And that's not true. So they're just like, what? And then they know Daniel's drug dealing background. Could it be one of his drug dealing associates? Nothing. Right. They were just very, very confused. But okay. Miriam, ding, 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 you clocked it.
Yeah, did
it. It was all Jennifer.
Yeah, she did it.
Authorities were trying to like, and I don't know if it was the sense of like black guy, dreadlock, Jamaican accent. It's like, really? Yeah, okay. Also, so they started to suspect that Jennifer wasn't being on the up and up also, but then Han woke up her father.
Okay.
So, and he told them that basically he said, that what he remembered on that night is that he saw his daughter talking casually with one of the men and walking around the home unbound.
Yeah.
And he said to them, look into what Jennifer did. Which is the name of a documentary that I saw on Netflix. What Jennifer did. So with this new info, the authorities said about finding evidence. So then they brought Jennifer back in. Because as much as Jennifer did this, she wasn't very good at this kind of stuff. And
no.
I think ultimately Jennifer, and I think it's just hard for parents to understand. And I think this is something specifically Asian American, Asian Canadian people that... I think it's hard for their parents to realize that their kids are just mediocre, just regular. They're not extraordinary. They're not exceptionally smart. They're just regular kids.
There's no ethnicity that's particularly smarter than another ethnicity.
Yeah. And you this may be hard for that. Immigrant parents in general to understand that their kids may be regular, because in their mind, their kids can't afford to be regular. And they're not wrong. Again, I empathize with the parents. But Jennifer, she ain't the most, she's just a regular student. She's just a regular girl.
She'd be fine. She'd get A's and B's and some C's.
Yeah, maybe
shouldn't take the highest math.
Or she, I think she probably, and we'll get into it. She started off as an A student because that's all she did. She didn't have any friends. She didn't have a boyfriend. Right. She wasn't a kid. And then Daniel came into her life and some of her grades started to slip because she was obsessed with her boyfriend, that kind of thing. But she was just a regular girl, right? And I don't think her parents could accept that. So authorities begin, you know, bringing her in and finding consistencies in her story. They even brought her in. They were like, so tell us how you were tied up. How were you able to make the 911 call if you were tied up? And so she sort of like demonstrates it. And it's just like, okay, that could work, I guess. But they also, and they got a warrant for her phone. So when they got her phone, they found a series of texts and they hit the mother load.
Oh my gosh, she's stupid. Okay.
Between her and somebody called Homeboy, I'm like, oh my God.
Okay.
And with Daniel.
Yeah.
And basically they found out that she had plotted with Homeboy that she met through Daniel to kill her parents for about $10,000.
Jesus.
This is what they felt like the evidence showed. So with this new evidence on November 22nd. Now, again, the home invasion happened on November 8th, 2010. November 22nd, they officially arrested her. The following year, in the spring of 2011, they arrested Daniel, a man by the name of Linford Crawford, a.k.a. Homeboy.
That was Homeboy. Okay.
Yeah. And two other men, David Malvanganem and Eric Carty, who were involved in the incident. Now, in the documentary that I watched, and then also in the research that I did with news, with articles and things like that, it said that when she finally broke down, and they were just trying to lead her down to admit it.
Yeah.
She said that she actually originally paid them to kill her. That she was just, it was just too much because she didn't have anybody. Daniel had moved on with his new girlfriend, Christine. Her parents had found out that she had lied about all this stuff and she just felt so alone. And so she had paid them to kill her, but it had gone wrong.
I still don't believe
But that
her.
Didn't hold up in evidence.
No, that doesn't make any sense to me. No.
So 4 years later in 2014, the trial began. And prosecution asserted that...
Wait, was she free for those 4 years?
No.
She was in jail. Okay.
Yeah, she was in jail. So...
That's good, because she murders people. Okay.
Yeah, because she's also a flight risk and like, yeah. So
yeah, for sure.
She... So in the trial in 2014, she's 28 at this time. So she's well on her way. The prosecution asserted that Jennifer got a text that night from quote unquote Homeboy telling her basically it was on. And then she went downstairs to say hi to her mother because originally she said that her mother had gone out to line dancing. So her mother had gotten into line dancing and had come back home. She was tired. So she was soaking her feet downstairs. So she went downstairs to say hi to her mother. Her father had already gone off to bed. So she said hi to her mother. When she did that, she went over to the front door and unlocked it. And then went back upstairs and to wait for things to go down.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
She's like a cold hearted.
Yeah.
Damn, that's psychotic.
They
right?
also found out this is basically the real truth of what was going on. So they also found out in July of 2010. So what?
3 months?
Three months before she had reached out to a man by the name of Ricardo Duncan and given him $1,500, offered him $1,500 to kill her father. But he ghosted her after she paid him. And it was only later that she realized she had been scammed. But Duncan was like, no. what had happened was, no. He said that she asked him to kill her parents. He did do that. And he was like, first of all, what, you think I'm a killer? No. And then he said that she was like, no, 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 I need you to do this. So he gave her, so she gave him only $200, which that don't really hold up Duncan, what? But okay, I get it. Duncan's like, okay. My name is Bennett. I ain't in it. Keep me out of this foolishness.
Right.
But, and he's like, she gave me $200 and I returned the money. So keep my name out of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also, it was also revealed in the trial that, and this is so sad, that Jennifer in eighth grade, she began self-harming by cutting herself.
Ugh.
So again, I think this is sadly, this is a story of, you know, parents from another world not understanding exactly what their kids are going through. And then also being like, ain't nobody got time for these mental health issues.
Yeah.
Go to school, work hard, and you'll feel better. And not understanding, you know, I think maybe part of them is like, our kids are gone soft. Because I think especially first generation kids have that pressure. Their parents don't want them to be too of the new place that they're in, but they are of that new place.
Yeah. And it is interesting because you go to these places and you succeed so that you can give your kids a better life. But then you feel like they're missing something.
Yeah.
And you have to find that balance. Because there's a reality to the world they live in.
And your kids are not you. And so right. Finding that. I empathize with her parents because they're like, we had time to be feeling sad. We had to work. But it's
you got to make time.
Yeah, you're not in Vietnam anymore, parents. Like, you're not. And it's a different time. You know, and your kids are young. And young people are different. They have a different way of communicating.
Right.
And again, you don't think it's going to lead to this. Your kid's trying to kill you.
That's
right?
I think there was some psychoticness. Hanging out there, waiting to be unleashed. Maybe.
Yeah, I'm going to get into that. So, also at trial, like I said, she began cutting herself, which that is very, very sad. That's a cry for help, obviously.
Yeah,
obviously, she didn't feel comfortable enough to tell her parents.
Right,
they wouldn't understand.
Sad.
And they wouldn't. She's not wrong there. But when she got to high school, she found solace when she met Daniel. Because again, Daniel's also of Chinese descent.
Right.
First gen, but he's also kind of cool in her eyes. He's not nerdy Asian guy that's only learning piano and going to school. He's sort of kind of cool, right?
Right.
And he's a senior. And like I said, he had to transfer to another school when police found marijuana in his car.
Okay.
At that point, her grades started to slip from A's to B's, which again, her parents, but she's not telling them this, of course. Now, she did get into Ryerson. She was accepted early, but they withdrew the offer when she failed calculus her senior year.
Oh, so she took calculus. Okay. See, I never did that.
So again, Jennifer probably shouldn't have been taking calculus.
She shouldn't have been taking calculus.
Yeah.
That's okay.
She probably shouldn't have been taking.
I'm still pretty
smart. And she's missing Daniel, and then she's trying to meet with him. She's just, it's a lot going on. After that, she started forging her report cards. And she did claim that she was going to Ryerson in the fall because, of course, she couldn't tell them.
Right.
So it's like she's thinking, oh, I'm going to catch up. But again, Jennifer's going through a lot of emotional stuff. She's not emotionally capable. And it's like, girl, these lies are going to catch up with you sooner or later. So, but she just wasn't thinking that. Her brain's not fully formed. She's not really thinking.
Yeah.
And she's in that love bombing. She's just in love and she just wants to be with Daniel. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So she basically kept up the lie. She told her father that she would transfer to the University of Toronto after 2 years at Ryerson. And then, she even claimed that she had gotten a $3,000 scholarship to go to Ryerson.
Cute.
Her father was so proud. He bought her a new laptop. So she was like, it's all going great. So to keep up the facade when the fall came around, she would just leave the house like she's going to Ryerson and she would just go to cafes or go to Daniel's dorm room and then pretend to be going to class. So
damn.
And then in 2006 when she was like, oh, I got transferred to Toronto, you know, that's when all this stuff started happening and they're like, oh, okay, that's great, everything's going great. Now in 2008 when graduation was looming, she claimed that the university only gave her one ticket per student for people to come and see her graduate, so she gave hers to a friend as to not exclude the other parent.
Wow.
Yeah.
Liar.
Also, during trial, we found out on the night of November 8th, Crawford, aka homeboy, texted her, quote, after work, okay, will be game time. So her father's in bed. Her mother's downstairs reading, soaking her feet. So she went downstairs to say hello to her, to say goodnight to her mom, say hello to her mom, and then goodnight. She unlocked the door. At 10:02 p.m., she turned the lights on in the upstairs study to give them a signal.
Yeah.
3 minutes later, the three guys came in, and they dragged her parents into the basement and covered their heads in blankets. They shot her mother 3 times in the head.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Shot their her father too, but he may have been, struggling so much. So they only managed to get him in the face and the shoulder, and they thought they had killed him. So they fled. And then they, before they dragged her parents to the downstairs, this is also after the father saw her walking around talking to them unbound. They put her upstairs. They bound her to make it look good and then took the parents down. So they didn't, Jennifer, because she's upstairs doing this act of calling the 911 call and pretending to yell to her father because she's thinking her father's dead, right? Or he's going to die. She didn't realize that her father had survived. So that was that was something that was a surprise after on later.
I appreciate the surprise. Yes.
Yeah. The trial lasted for 10 months.
Damn.
And can you, this was like crazy. Also, just like these are Asian people. Again, this is not something that you, this is something you definitely could think of white kids honestly doing. I'm just going to say like Menendez brothers, hello. Yeah. Like killing their parents. You just, they did not expect this at all. Right. But in the end, after 10 months, on December 13th, 2014, Jennifer, Jennifer Pan, Daniel Wong, Cardi, Crawford, and Melvanganam were found guilty of first degree murder and attempted murder.
Yeah.
In January of 2015, they received life sentences with no chance of parole and additional life sentences to be served concurrently. Eric Cardi was convicted of conspiracy to commit murder in 2015 and received an 18-year sentence.
Okay.
Now, when the jury read the first degree murder conviction, Jennifer didn't show any emotion. But when the press left the courtroom, reportedly, she began to cry uncontrollably. In her father, Han's victim impact statement, which was read, it said, quote, "When I lost my wife, I lost my daughter at the same time. Yeah. I don't feel like I have a family anymore. Some say I should feel lucky to be alive, but I feel like I am dead, too." End quote. Today, 2024, Han, he's unable to work because of his injuries. He suffers from anxiety attacks, insomnia, nightmare, all the stuff. His son, Felix, moved to the East Coast to escape the controversy surrounding their family. And he said and it's said that Felix also suffers from depression.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, in his statement, her father also addressed Jennifer. He said, quote, I hope my daughter Jennifer thinks about what has happened to her family and can become a good person, a good, honest person someday, end quote.
Wow.
Now, a little bit, I'm almost finished here, but an update. In May of 2014. In May of 2023, the Ontario Appeals Court ordered a retrial for all four defendants on the first degree murder charge. Their lawyers argued in part that it was unfair for the judge to only present two options to the jury, that the attack was either planned and deliberate with the intention to murder both parents, or that the attack arose out of part of a home invasion and robbery gone wrong. So Jennifer and Daniel, along with the other three defendants, all had their convictions overturned last year and are currently awaiting retrials. But meanwhile, Jennifer's conviction for the attempted murder of her father remains. Thus, the life sentence she received for the crime is still carried out.
So it doesn't make a difference for her.
No, it's just semantics also, because it's about like, will they be eligible for parole at like whatever time? It's all this legal stuff that I didn't get into because, again, hashtag not historians or lawyers.
Yeah, facts.
Now, what I also want to talk about, the cultural significance of this. So because there was backlash, there's been backlash to the documentary on Netflix called What Jennifer Did.
Okay.
Karen K. Ho, a business owner and art, a crime reporter, a business and art crime reporter in New York City, who went to school with both Jennifer and Daniel, wrote an article for Toronto Life in 2015 after the trial that detailed the complexities of the case and Pam's family dynamic, emphasizing the pressures placed on Jennifer and other children of immigrant families. Mm-hmm. Jennifer and her family are ethnically Chinese, like I said, but her parents came to Canada as refugees from Vietnam.
Right.
She says, this is Karen, says that true crime's primary audience are white people and white Americans, and that the documentaries are primarily produced through a white lens. She's not wrong. Because what Jennifer did is a bunch of white people talking. There is one lady who was sort of like the victim advocate, who she said her parents are from the Caribbean. And so she's like, I definitely understand the pressures that Jennifer was under.
Yeah.
Being the child of immigrants and like that pressure. But most of the people talking were white men, the investigators.
Yeah.
And now Karen says it's not surprising that Jennifer and her father declined to speak on camera about this, or that the documentary relies heavily on interviews with and footage from police. But now co-producer Paul Nguyen says director Penny Popplewell reached out to him 2 years ago to help connect with the members of the Markham's Vietnamese community for what Jennifer did. And he said that, quote, I can relate being a Vietnamese person, second generation, and having pressures from my own parents. And sometimes it hurt me and upset me a lot. But I wouldn't resort to something like this, he told CBC Toronto. End quote. And he says, you know, mental health issues are, quote, very taboo subject in Asian communities.
Yeah.
End quote. And he's like, he's just hoping that while not perfect, that the documentary will maybe help open up dialogue and more healing for people who are coming from those situations of this high expectations, this pressure. Also, parents, again, parents, not all your kids are special snowflakes. Like, not all of them are going to go to University of Toronto and become a doctor. They're not. And that's okay. It doesn't mean your kids are stupid or not special or not worthy of love. And I think sometimes that's what the parents don't understand, that the message that they're sending to their kids is that their kids are not worthy of love if they don't achieve.
Right. It's not necessarily the message they're trying to give, but it's what's being gone.
That's what's coming through. And the kids, again, I empathize with both the position of the kids and the parents. And I think that, like, you know, to Paul's point, there needs to be some healing and some understanding in the communities, that the parents have to understand that their kids are not them. Their kids are living in a completely different. So again, the kids are having the pressure of being different, othered, right?
Right. Already.
You know, and also wanting to fit in, and fitting in means like you have some of the similar experiences of your classmates.
Yes.
You know, going to keggers, but while also being proud of your heritage, there's a balancing act that their kids are trying to do that the parents just don't understand and may not have enough sympathy for, because the parents are like, just go to school and get grades. Who cares? You don't need friends. But it's like, no, you do need friends.
Listen,
and you need a boyfriend.
Lovetta, I think it's a little too late, but I think if we could have gone back in time, it would have been better. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, to me, my more issues came from in the home, honestly. I was not very, very popular, but I was not like in high, especially in high school, because I love being a nerd and I hung around with nerds, because I think I was in high school when being a nerd was not like up for being ridiculed. I went to like a high achieving high school. So I was around other nerdy kids. But I had a lot of Asian American friends, and some of them, I remember one girl, Kat Tien Vo. Kat looked like she was 12. Kat looked young to even us in high school.
Okay.
And Kat had like a silver streak of hair already, but she looked like she was 12. She looked like she was still like in sixth grade. And she always looked worried, and we all worked really, really hard and studied really, really hard. We were all nerds. I mean, we were also very innocent and sheltered in a lot of ways. Like, we would get together and watch Disney movies. Like, that was our thing. Like,
that's what I did too.
Yeah. So we were all
saw
very
Aladdin 17 times in the theater. Okay.
But we found it a badge of honor to be nerds. And yeah, so we had like friendly competition about who could be the smartest or whatever. But it's all about like how many colleges can you apply to and how many can you get in. But I know, especially for the Asian American kids, and it's varying different degrees, because I had a friend who was Filipino and her parents were like, whatever, girl. Like, you know, like, you know what I mean? But then like the every year we had the Comia sisters, who were also Filipino. And like every year, one of the Comia sisters would be valedictorian, a salutatorian in every class, because there were a bunch of them. Yeah. So like the Comia sisters, they're Filipino, but their parents were like, you better go and get these grades. OK, whereas my friend Joanne, her parents are like, you know, and then but then you have like,
I think it really has to do with how recently you got to this country, whatever country it is that you're, you know, Canada or US or whatever, because I see it in my world too with kids, but it really, from what I see, it's just about how recently you got here. It's not necessarily like, I understand the culture and where you come from, but I'm telling you, I see all kinds of cultures who are pushing kids, and it directly correlates with how recently you were here.
Yeah. So, you know what I would like to see though? I would like to see the story told by an Asian, a person of the Asian community, because I would really like to see how they see it through their lens, their POV. I think it would give us a rich...
They should make the movie.
Yeah, I think that that's something that I would really, really want to see. And I think that that would give a whole nother sort of slant to it and give us more depth, and perhaps get Han, if he's willing, or Felix, her brother, to talk about it, because they feel like they're talking to a sympathetic, you know, producers, people who really understand them, you know, on a deep level, that just white people are just putting their things, even me as a black person, like I have my own experience, I'm also, you know, it's my family's been in America since like I can trace them back 1700s. Like, so, like, you know what I mean? So like, it's a very different experience, even though I had friends who I could see on the outside going through this. And some of them, you know, they navigated it very differently in different ways, but they also had different kinds of parents. And like you said, depending on when the parents came here. Also, I think it depends on their economic level, because my one friend whose parents were still working class, they were like, the fact you're going to school is great. Whereas like if you have high achieving parents, you know, they have a whole different kind of expectations as well.
I mean, exactly. I mean, like, it really just depends. Think it is a phenomenal, but a phenom in this world we live in. But I bet you if we did some sort of social study on it, we would find a link more towards the most recent
arrival. Because this is 2010, too.
Yeah.
So I really would love to see an Asian-Canadian producer take this on.
I would love to see an Asian-Canadian producer make a movie of it, so you can see background and history, and it would be a good movie. And so you'd also show a lot of other Asian people in really good lights. The problem is, like, a documentary on this one girl who murdered her parents doesn't look
good. A documentary told by white people, too. Like, and this would be a great role for an Asian actress.
Yes.
Like, yeah, this would be, because, yeah, what is going on with Jennifer? Like, is she, and it's so interesting because I watched it, because in the documentary, they have the police interviews, and I could have gone to high school. I could have gone to high school with her. Like, she totally seems very familiar to me. I could have gone to high school with her and Daniel, because again, I know a lot of it's like not all, and that's the thing, the whole stereotype about being Asian. It's like, no, Asian people are people too. There's all different kinds, but so hopefully that will be in the works. But that is Jennifer Pan.
Thank you so much. I learned a lot today. What interesting a journey we were on.
She paid to have her parents killed, murked.
Him.
I mean, we knew something was up, Jennifer, girl. You've been in Canada too long. You're like, oh, it was some black dudes.
Yeah, I was
even
like,
though it did turn out to be black dudes, but
I mean, but what? Just, oh my God. All right. Yeah. All right.
If she had been like, I couldn't really see their face. They may have been white. That actually would have worked out better.
Better than like they had a Jamaican accent with dreads.
Dreadlocks.
Girl.
Yeah.
I'm racist. What? So. Like, what?
Like, it's like, oh, okay, girl. But it was a very interesting story. So, all right, guys, that wraps it up for another episode of Notorious Women Podcast. Guys, remember to follow us on all the things. Leave us a 5-star review. We will get into more of those as soon as we have some new ones to share. So please leave us a 5-star review in the Apple Store. It helps people find us. And leave us 5 stars or a review on any other place where you get your podcast. Also, if you want to help us financially and you want to donate to our Patreon, you can do that at patreon.com/notoriouswomen. That's patreon.com/notoriouswomen. And Miriam, how else can they support the show?
Y'all come over to Instagram. It's Notorious Women Podcast. Very, very easy to find. You can DM us there. Go ahead and let me know what you think about that. I like the Instagram. It's fun. I feel like it's sort of an addition to the podcast. I think they work well with each other.
It's amazing.
You can also email us at notoriouswmpod@gmail.com. Side note, you can also listen to episodes on YouTube at Notorious Women Podcast if you want to do that. And that is that.
Yeah, guys. And we will see you next week. Be safe. And don't get murked, please. And don't be murking nobody. Don't do that either.
All right.
Don't do that either. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.